Regardless of where you are in your homesteading journey, whether you are just starting out or you've been at it for a while, there is no way that any of us can know absolutely everything when it comes under the homesteading umbrella. And this is where it is key that you are learning from people who have life experience and have been doing this homesteading when it comes to livestock in the kitchen, but they have been doing it for a long time so that you can bypass the mistakes that they have made along the way. And getting it delivered in your mailbox, in your hands every single month from some of the most trusted voices in homesteading is exactly what you need. And Homestead Living now has Homesteading Monthly, which is an in-print monthly magazine featuring articles from Joel Salatin, myself, Carolyn Thomas, as well as homesteaders who you may not have heard from them, but they have been perfecting their craft and are very much an expert in their area. You can get this for less than $2 an issue. Yes, that is an in-print, jam-packed with articles every single month. Go to homesteadliving.com and grab your subscription right now.
Welcome to Pioneering Today with me, Melissa K. Norris, where I inspire your faith and your pioneer roots. I show you how to grow your own food, heirloom gardening, how to preserve your food at home, and modern homesteading. Tune in every other Friday as I share proven strategies that anyone can do to live the pioneer lifestyle. Make sure to head over to melissaknorris.com and subscribe to receive free Pioneering Today articles and updates. I don't know about you guys, but we are super crazy busy with the garden this time of year. The height of summer is also the height of our busy season with growing our own fruits and vegetables along with the livestock and then processing it all, preserving it. So this episode is dedicated to talking about organic gardening and bug control methods. So I'm just going to kind of share some of the things that we have going on here. And a new addition that I'm adding to the Pioneering Today podcast is recently, if you didn't catch it, I'm sorry, it was awesome, but it's still going on and it's the Summer of Survival Summit. And I did a webinar on home food preservation and there was a ton of questions, too many for us to get to during the live question and answering session. So I'm going to take a question and answer it on the show here each week until we get through them all. So one of the first questions that I had was in regards to water bath canning. And the question was, if you don't have a rack, what can you use in the bottom of your pot when you are processing your jars via water bath? And that's an excellent question, because for many years I did not have a pot actually, a rack to put in my pot. And so I've used a rolled up dish towel. So you just kind of twist it up into a circle and then submerge that and put it at the bottom of your pot. And then your jars just sit on top of that and it keeps them up off of the bottom of the heat source so that they're not directly on the heat source at the bottom of the pan. And then it allows the hot and the heat to circulate all the way around the jar. And another thing you can use, and this was actually in the comment section, which was fabulous, is, you know, the old rusted, the rings from when you're canning, you know, we don't want to use the rusted ones. They don't tend to screw on well, and sometimes they can inhibit a seal. So don't toss those out. There's actually a couple good uses for them. And one of them is to use those rusted out rings and put those in the bottom of your water bath canner and use those as a rack to lift your jars up. That's an excellent idea. And another thing that I use those rusted out lids for is I do basically the same process, because they are fine in high heat situations. They were made from canning. Is I use those in the bottom of my slow cooker or my crock pot when I am cooking a whole chicken. And so a lot of the times I will roast a whole chicken in our slow cooker, and to keep it up off the bottom so it's more succulent and it really does mimic a rotisserie chicken without a rotisserie, is use some of those rings and put them in the bottom and put your chicken on top of them in the slow cooker. So those are two things that I really like to use the old rusted out rings for. I always like to repurpose things any way I can. I hate tossing something out if there's still a viable use for it, even if it's not its intended use. So that is going to be our question that we're answering today on the canning. And next week, I will have another one. And so I wanted to talk about gardening, organic gardening in particular. It's kind of funny, when I was growing up, organic wasn't that big as it is now. But pretty much my family, and so then I in turn have always practiced organic gardening. And that's mainly just because we didn't really have the money and we didn't have stores nearby to use chemicals. We practiced, the way my grandparents and my great grandparents gardened. And that was before, you know, tons of pesticides were developed and those kinds of a thing. So I always like to tease and say that we practiced organic gardening before organic was cool, or before everybody knew what organic was. So basically, organic gardening is just the art and practice of gardening without synthetic chemicals and pesticides. So there are some organic means of pest control, actually, and I've used a couple of those, and we'll talk about those. So when we do organic gardening and the methods in our garden, we don't use, we don't use insecticides or synthetic fertilizers, that kind of a thing. So it's just, exactly as God created it and natural. So we're not introducing chemicals and pesticides that have been linked to a lot of health issues cropping up from the continued use and increased use of them, actually, with our regular food source if they're not an organic farmer. So I also, this week, I wanted to share, I loved this article that I read. So I kind of wanted to share it briefly with you. And it's from journeywithjill.net. And she's doing a series on what the Bible says about food. And I love it. It really made me sit and think. And she's really, I just love what she has to say. And I'm going to put it in the show notes, actually. I'm going to link to the beginning of the series so you can catch it. But the gist of what she said is, we practice organic, heirloom, non-GMO as much as possible. And so she really wanted to look at what the Bible says about food. And I love it because she's looking at it from the viewpoint is, do we, those of us who practice organic and, really try to eat whole traditional foods, eat healthy and that kind of a thing. She was coming as, like when you're at the grocery store, or maybe at somebody's home or a potluck, and you see somebody who is eating a lot of processed, sugary, non-healthy foods, are you looking at them with judgment? I thought, wow. There's been a few times that I've been in the grocery store and, you see somebody with a cart full of, 10 cases of a Diet Coke or, whatever, five, bags of potato chips and a whole bunch of Twinkies and stuff. And I have to say, maybe I have looked at them with judgment, or maybe, as we talk about and I practice, the whole foods and the organic, have I used that as a prideful thing? Has that made me more prideful than it should? And so she really just looks at the heart of it without being judgmental, and just kind of causes you to sit and ponder that a little bit. And then she looks at different Bible verses, and I'm really loving the series. It's just started. So if you want to catch that, it's journeywithjill.net, and it's a Bible study on what the Bible says about food. So I'll provide a link for that in the show notes. So for the show notes or any of the things that I'm talking about, you can just go to melissaknorris.com and click on the podcast button. And then I have each episode is listed there. So you can just click on that and go in and then look at the links and stuff listed under the show notes. So that's resources available for you. And so, we practice with organic gardening. I want to say probably the best bet with organic gardening, your best defense, your first line of defense, is to make sure your plants are healthy. So if you have a healthy plant that does start to get attacked by, a disease or a pest infestation, if the plant's healthy, it's going to have a much better chance of coming through and surviving than an unhealthy plant. So my first line of defense is just to keep our soil healthy. And so what we do, actually you start in the fall, is put down a good layer, of mulch. So, or you can do a cover crop. We have actually done both. And we'll talk about more about those later when it gets, to the fall season. So you can do it more in depth, but, you can put dried leaves down
Or you can plant a variety of cover crops, and that's going to help your soil during the winter months when it's kind of fallow and sleeping. And so that's the first thing that we do. And then in the spring, we always like to mix in, we have chickens, and there's actually a really large chicken farm pretty near my husband's work. And so my husband works at a sawmill, actually. He saws guitar tops, primarily for Taylor and Martin guitars. Even though we're really rural, it's kind of funny. He has a works at a sawmill that saws the guitar tops. So anyways, they have a lot of byproduct of sawdust, as you can imagine. And sawdust can actually be good for the garden. And so they get chicken manure and mix it with the sawdust, and then that breaks down. They let it sit because chicken manure is really hot. It's very high in nitrate, but it's really, really hot. So you don't want to put it on fresh into your garden or it can burn your plants. And so they let that sit and cool off and start to break down and create compost with the sawdust. So it's a great way to use it. They use it around the mill. They have a vegetable garden and fruit and flower beds there. And then the workers are allowed to bring some home. And so we mix that into our vegetable garden every spring before we plant. And we mix that into the soil really good. So if you have access to chicken manure, any manure, as long as it's not hot or it's not fresh, you want it to be dry is best. You don't want it to be wet. So you can do pig manure, llama, cow, horse, any kind of animal manure is really good for the garden. And so one of the ways that you can introduce that into is to make a manure tea. And I know it sounds kind of gross to think tea and you're like, okay, but your plants will thrive with manure tea. And there's lots of different ways that you can do it. You can even use like comfrey or stinging nettle leaves and create like a compost tea. And you can use that. Probably the simplest method that I've seen is to take like a big five gallon bucket. And you're going to probably want a bucket with a lid on it, because one, when you're making, you know, manure tea and compost tea and that kind of thing, it's going to have an odor. So you're going to want a lid on it just to keep the odor and then to keep it from getting knocked and spilt over. If you have young kids, obviously you don't want them falling in it or playing in it or that kind of a thing. So a large bucket with a lid is preferable. And then you're going to fill it with the manure, and you're going to fill it up about a quarter to a half with the manure, and then you're going to fill the rest up with water, and then you're going to let that sit for about 3 weeks, and then you're going to want to drain it. So if you have a bucket or a container with a spigot on the bottom, then that's going to make it really easy to drain. Otherwise, you're going to want to use like a really, you know, like an old t-shirt, really old towel, something that you don't obviously care about using again, or wearing, I should say. And so you can use that and drain it out, and then you have a manure or compost tea. And so you don't want to use that tea full strength, though, because, again, you can burn your plants. And you only are going to want to apply it in the middle of the growing season, you know, about every 3 weeks if it's a plant that's really producing a lot, or if it's in more poor soil. You could do it maybe every other week. And so you're going to want to pour that around the base of the plant and let it soak it up. So when you're making the manure tea, you're going to want to use about 1 pint to 2 gallons of water. So you're really diluting it down, because we don't want to burn our plants. So you just want to make sure that you do not put it on full strength. If you're wanting to spray it on the leaves, now this is going to depend on the kind of type of plant that you have and that you're feeding. Like tomatoes and peppers, we don't want to spray it on the leaves. They don't want moisture on the leaves at all. They like to keep their leaves really dry. But you can mix like a tablespoon or so of like vegetable oil, and that's going to help keep it on the leaves. It's going to help it stick to the leaves so that they can absorb it. So that's one of the ways that you can organically feed your plants instead of using, you know, synthetic plant foods and that kind of a thing, especially on like your vegetable garden. I do not fertilize after we plant. We keep our soil amended well with compost. And then when I'm planting, for instance, my tomatoes and my peppers, when I plant those, I put compost down in the hole. And then I also crush up eggshells for the extra calcium boost into the hole for the tomatoes and the peppers. And then I also add a little bit of Epsom salt as well. So that's all that I do for those. I don't add fertilizer throughout the summer months to the vegetable garden. We have a pretty prolific garden and haven't had a problem with that, but we do take pretty good care of the soil. So it's going to depend on this condition of your soil when you first put your plants on, whether or not you need to fertilize, or how heavy they're feeding throughout the year. And then, but one thing that we do do, and this is a really good way to introduce, if you're going to be for your anything that likes a little bit of an acidic level and that you want to add some compost to, and this works really good for potatoes. If you mix in acidicness to your potatoes, it will help the scab from forming. You know, on potatoes, when you grow them at home, a lot of times they can get kind of scabby on the outside. Well, if you have extra acidicness into your soil, then that helps the scab from forming. So one of the ways to do that is you can use dried leaves, just dried leaves from trees that have fallen, and you kind of mulch them up when you're hilling your potatoes and put that in there. And as those break down, as the potatoes are forming, then that's going to help stop the scab from forming. And then another thing that you can do, and this works great for lots of plants. I use this method for our blueberries, our raspberries, tomatoes, peppers, potatoes. And then if you have flowers, it works really great for hydrangeas, azaleas, and rhododendrons. And so I used our used coffee grounds. So reuse those coffee grounds. One caveat I would give is if you're doing this, then you're going to want to use, at least I do, is organic coffee grounds. Coffee actually can have a lot of pesticides on it. So if you're not using, if it's just regular coffee, think about using the grounds beforehand, especially on your edibles. It'd be fine for your flowers, but on our soil, I don't like to introduce things that aren't. So organic coffee grounds is what we use, and you're just going to use the used grounds. So after you make your coffee, take those used grounds, and then I work those into the soil. So I work them around the base of the tomato plants, pepper plants, in with the potatoes, actually, when we're hilling them up. And then I work those into the mulch and the sawdust at the bottom of the raspberries and the blueberries. And so one of the things you want to remember is you don't want to mix it in too heavily or leave it a lot of clumps. You want to mix it in well. If you leave it in big, huge clumps because it's already wet, especially if it's wet when you're putting it out, which we're in the Pacific Northwest, so it's wet a lot of the time here. So if it's too wet, then it's going to introduce mold, and then it's not going to break down as fast and get the nutrients into the soil. So I've heard a lot of people say that they think that it helps with slugs and that kind of a thing, but the used coffee grounds isn't a huge, highly acidic level, and I really haven't noticed that it's done anything for the slugs, quite honestly. But it has really worked well on the plants. My blueberries and raspberries love it, and so do the acidic-loving plants. So, and you also, if you have, when you're planting your tomatoes this year, we actually got a flea beetle on the peppers and the tomato plants and some of the potatoes as well. And so it's a little black beetle that jumps around like a flea. It doesn't get us, but it eats the foliage of the plant, especially when it's young and really succulent. And so it can damage the leaves, you know, and weaken the plant. And then if it's really heavy infestation, it's a really young plant, sometimes it can kill it. So one of the ways that I was researching to get rid of this organically, beans that we had them, was to use coffee grounds. And they said the best way was to put the coffee grounds in the soil when you're planting your tomato plants, because the flea beetle hatches out in spring. And when you put the coffee grounds in, and then I think it also helps when they lay their eggs, that they don't like the coffee for whatever reason. And so then they don't lay their eggs, and then they're not going to be hatching as much. So that is something that I'm going to be trying this following spring, is using the coffee grounds in when I plant my tomatoes. So this is our first year battling with the flea beetles, which I haven't lost any plants of yet. And I have to say, when you're doing organic gardening, especially with the pest control, being out with your plants daily and checking on them is key. And the reason for that is if you go 5 days without checking on them and something has started an infestation, by day five, it's probably too late, especially if it's something that does a lot of damage really quick. But if you're out there every day and you're noticing the little things just as they start to pop up, it's much easier to control and to fix something if it's just right at the beginning. So I would recommend walking through your garden, you know, try on a daily basis, if not every day. We're out there pretty much every day, you know, looking at things, working, weeding, harvesting, whatever. So keep a really good eye on it. And, you know, a lot of times manual removal is really good. And so I actually went through, and the little flea beetles, if I could catch them, I was smushing them. And then if there was a lot on a certain leaf, I would take that leaf and pinch it off and remove them far, far, far away from the tomato in the garden area and just discard of them that way. So that's one way. And then another way, and I've actually used this in our little mini orchard. And this is a natural and it's organic insect spray, and it's called neem's oil. And so neem is a tree out of Africa, I believe, and the oil in it, a lot of bugs don't like. And so it works on quite a few different things. I bought it in a concentrate form, and so you have to put it in a spray bottle. And whenever you're spraying anything on your plants, you want to make sure that you're not doing it in the hot heat of the day, because you don't want to burn the leaves. So usually early morning is best. And then I don't like to do it at night because the dew is going to be coming and it can wash it off. And obviously if it's going to be raining, then you don't want to spray either. And usually, at least here, it's really best if you're going to be spraying anything to do it in the morning before the wind comes up. Here, usually in the evening, we get a lot of breeze kicking through. And so trying to spray something, as you can well imagine, when it's windy out, doesn't work so well. You're going to get a face full of it. And even if it is organic, I still don't want it, on my skin and breathing it and blowing on me. So with the neem's oil, you can use that. I've had pretty good success with that. We had, I'm not sure what it was last year, but it was something that was killing the leaves on the apple tree, and it was a young tree, and it was killing so many leaves that I was concerned that actually it was going to kill the tree. And so I got the organic neem's oil and sprayed that on. And then usually with the neem's oil, you have to spray again in about 10 more days. So it requires two applications. And so we used that, and I still have the bottle of concentrate. And another caveat though, is when you're mixing it up in a spray bottle, label that spray bottle that it's only to be used for that, so you don't accidentally use it for, house cleaner or whatever else. And then when you're spraying, don't save this spray. You need to spray it and use all of it or discard of it safely. You don't want to save it in the bottle and then reuse it later. You just want to mix up what you're going to use at that time, use it, and then get rid of it. So another organic pest method that we've had for the garden is Dimectis Earth. So if you've never heard of Dimectis Earth is a great kind of all-purpose homesteading thing. You can get food grade, which means that it's safe. And so Dimectis Earth is just a great thing. A lot of people will use it in the chicken coop. So you can use it. It's a dust. It's a white powder. And so you can use that in the chicken coop, in the beds. And so if you're using that in the beds, you're going to want to sprinkle it down like in their nesting boxes and that kind of a thing. And you can actually dust them with it or sprinkle it where they have take their dust bath at. And so that's going to help. It helps clean and get rid of mites, which we love if you have chickens and and you don't want to have to worry about it. And so why it works and how it's so good is a lot of times you'll hear DE2. People just shorten it if you hear people talking about that. So it's kind of like an off-white, like a talc powder. And it's what it is it's fossilized remains of marine phytoplankton. Hopefully I pronounced that right. And so when it's sprinkled on a bug that has an exoskeleton, so think ants, fleas, mites, that kind of a thing, it compromises the coating, and so then it dissolves the outside of their skeleton, basically. So it doesn't hurt us, and actually it's a lot of you'll find, especially the food grade DE is in a lot of grain-based foods, because it's stored with the Dimectis Earth to keep the bugs from eating it. So a lot of people really like to keep DE on hand, and they use it not just with chickens, but they use it in the garden. So a lot of times if you have, things are bugging, like your cabbage, broccoli, even your beans. I've had people say they've had ants that will try to eat the beans. You can sprinkle the Dimectis Earth around the plant. If you get it on the plant, it's not going to hurt it, but do it around the plant and then the animals won't want to be crossing across it. And so then it's going to help protect the plant. They won't be able to get to it that way. One thing too is, I'm not sure how well it works with slugs. I haven't tried it with slugs, even though we're in the Pacific Northwest. I haven't had a huge, huge problem with slugs eating the garden. So I haven't tried that, but I would much rather recommend the DE to you than salt. I know a lot of people say they use salt to kill slugs, but if you keep adding salt, a lot of it, to your soil year after year, the salt isn't great for your soil or your plants. So I would try the DE. That works great. And then another thing, a good organic method for cabbage, cauliflower, anything that that those moths lay with broccoli drives me crazy. Is those moths, they will lay eggs and then it gets worms and stuff in it, which is just, ugh. If you've ever steamed broccoli and then eaten it and then looked in the steamer and saw all those little bright green worms in it that died when you were steaming it and you're like, oh great, how many of those did I eat? Then you're totally with me on this. Yeah, raising my hand. We have done that before. First year we did broccoli. I was so excited. I picked the first part of the season and brought it all in the house, steamed it up, and we ate, you know, huge amount of it. And then I got to look in the steamer and I saw all those worms, and my husband and I both, our stomachs just started turning, which was, you know, extra protein, totally fine. It killed him, but it still kind of was like, oh, gross. So one of the ways, in a gray organic way, to eliminate that is to get the row covers. So it's a cloth, it's a plant cloth, and you put these row covers on your broccoli and your cabbage when the moths are flying and laying their eggs, which is usually the beginning of the season. And so this cloth, the plants grow just fine underneath it, but it prevents them from landing and laying the eggs and then the eggs hatching out and the insects getting in your food to begin with. So this is a really good organic method, and you can reuse the cloths from year to year as long as you store them. And so that's a great way, an organic method, to keep the pests off without having to use a spray or doing a lot of work to the plants. And then another pest, especially for us here, is deer. And we also have a large elk herd, that's in the valley where we live, though it's not, we haven't had it on our property yet, which I really hope that that doesn't happen. Cause as you know, elk can be, especially a herd of them, can be quite destructive, to a place. So anyways, we're fortunate to have them, but we do have a lot of deer. And then we also have our cattle herd, which usually our fences are pretty good and they stay put, but every now and then a cow will get out. There's, you know, lots of small little herds where we live at. And so cows, you know, do get out, and cows like to trample and they like to eat things. So, between that and the deer, and plus, I love my chickens, my laying hens. They are great little free rangers, but they like to eat the food we like to eat. And so my strawberry plants this year, oh my goodness, the chickens and I went round and round and round. I had I'd been waiting for the strawberries. You know, when they're almost ripe enough, but not quite, and you're just waiting for them to reach that perfect peak sweetness, bright red, juicy, dripping. Oh my goodness. So the kids and I had been waiting for the first picking, and one more day, we were going to pick them the very next day. And so that night when I got home from work, we got our little buckets and we went out to pick those strawberries. And those cotton picking chickens had ate every single strawberry, including the green ones. I was so mad. In fact, we had just butchered our meat chickens 2 weeks before. And my daughter, I was so mad. She's like, Mama, are we going to butcher those chickens now too? Are we going to eat those ones? Because those chickens were getting a talking to, let me tell you. So I had to laugh, and I'm like, no, we're not going to butcher them. I said, but if they don't stay out of my strawberries, they are going to go in the stew pot. So long story short, my husband is so sweet and knew how mad at those chickens I were for eating all my strawberries, and I had more coming. So he used some netting and put some posts up, and we just put some netting around the raised beds to keep the chickens out of the strawberries. And I have to say, of all the different pest method controls for the deer and the chickens, rabbits, you name it, is fencing. Fencing and netting is just the best thing. It just works the best. So we have our garden fence, and we just use just regular metal fencing, T-posts, and some metal fencing around it. And it's a permanent garden spot. It was a one-time investment for us. We've had it up for, oh goodness, 6 years now. And so that keeps, you know, dogs, animals, everything except birds out of the vegetable garden. And then on the raspberries, our raspberries are so prolific that I haven't had to net those. But the blueberries, the birds, not just the chickens, but the birds, literally we will have blue jays and crows can strip a blueberry field here. I'm not kidding you, in like 24 hours when they're ripe. So we net our blueberries. I just actually string a wire over top of the smaller row. And we put a metal T-post into the ground on each end of the row, and we put a wire up above them, and then the netting goes over it like a tent. And then I tie it with jute twine at the bottom so that they can't get up underneath it. And so that's how I protect them. And then on the bigger bushes, we just use the netting and create kind of like a blanket on top of it, basically, to keep the birds out, and so that I still get my blueberry harvest. And then on the fruit trees, we have a dog. but he doesn't like to bark and chase the deer away. I swear he barks at everything else, but not the deer. We'll have deer in the yard like next to him, and he doesn't even bother him. So, which they're very pretty to look at, but they can strip a fruit tree really quick too. And not only do they eat the fruit, but they break off the branches and kind of damage the tree. So we've actually gotten the really tall metal fence posts. And then at the top around the tree, where the fruit and the main foliage is, we use, either like chicken wire or even like the hard plastic, netting. And we'll put that around in a square around, do four corners, four posts, and then we'll put that around the trees to keep them out. And so that's been our best defense against pests, the bigger pests, I should say, is organically. And that's just to keep them out of it to begin with. And so that's what we use the very absolute most. And so, and then another thing is too, is you want to remember, especially this time of the year, is your water levels. So if your plant's stressed, you're going to, any kind of bug, any kind of infestation or disease is really going to take it out a lot faster. So just remember to check. You don't want to overwater, but you don't want to underwater. So we found for our garden that doing a really good deep watering once to twice a week is much better than watering a little bit every day. And of course, this is going to depend on where you live, if you have water restrictions, how fast your soil is drying out, and that kind of a thing. But if you can, we found that a really good deep watering, in fact, we have some soaker hoses on the tomatoes and peppers, and I found that leaving them on for like 12 hours straight overnight a couple times a week has been the most beneficial. The plants are a lot healthier than trying to water just a little bit every night. So you'll just want to go out and walk through your garden and then address the issues as they crop up instead of letting them really big. So I would love to hear from you if you have any questions or suggestions or comments, and then we can address them on the air and on the next show. Thanks for listening.
And make sure to head over to melissaknorris.com to subscribe for free modern homesteading updates to help you live the simple life.